This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm going to start with a quote, and it is, "What it accomplished is said to have been scientifically considerable, but is not measurable now, and perhaps never will be. Such findings take years to write and codify and publish and disseminate. When that is completed, the use of them is only at the beginning." When journalist Colin Simpson wrote these words in 1951, I wonder if you could have imagined an event such as Barks, Birds and Billabongs being held at Australia's National Museum 58 years later. This event was planned to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the 1948 expedition, and it had little precedent. We've seen in the last decade conferences dedicated to the work of people like Thompson and Strelow, but dedicating the entire symposium to one particular expedition is still unusual in Australia. There is no question that the sheer volume of collections formed in 1948 have helped it to escalate its importance in the Australian psyche. And more specifically, most museums and researchers working on Australian collections had heard of the Arnhem Land expedition prior to our advertising beginning. Most state museums and art galleries in Australia hold some items collected in 1948. Yet, while the collections are the tangible result of the expedition, they are not the only reason for its importance. Interest in this expedition is much wider than just museum workers and researchers. It is Indigenous Australians. It's the descendants of the general public. Sorry, it's the descendants of the men and women who took part in the expedition. It's the members of the general public who grew up reading Charles Mountford's popular books or seeing his films. And it's the mums and dads who remember seeing the latest update on the expedition newspapers throughout 1948, including my own grandmother, who still remembers it. And it is much, much more. And I believe our understanding of the significance of this expedition really is just at the beginning. So, most of you will be by now aware that it took place in 1948. We asked the volunteers not to let anybody in who didn't know that. In February 1948, or more into March as well, a team of Australians and Americans came together in Darwin, Australia, to begin what at the time was one of the largest scientific expeditions ever to have taken place in Australia. They travelled across Arnhem Land until November 1948, basing their work around three key Aboriginal communities. That is Groote Eylandt, Yirrkala, and Owen Pelly, which is today now referred to as Goombalanya. Before I go into more detail, though, about the base camps and the scientific research that took place, I think it's important to understand a little bit about the origins of this expedition and the organisations at the forefront of the planning. In other words, it's my job here today to make sure that everybody is up to speed on the history and on the general history, and then later on presenters will go into more detail. Now, while on the surface, the pursuit of science and knowledge would seem to be the key motivator for the Arnhem Land expedition. In truth, politics was central to its success in attaining funding and international collaborators. And this can be better understood initially by looking at the leader of the expedition and a little bit of the planning prior to 1948. We will be hearing a great deal about Charles Mountford during the symposium, so I'm going to keep my background on him brief and focused. He was born in 1890 to a family of farmers and general labourers who lived throughout South Australia. Mountford insisted to his biographer Max Lamshed, some of you may have read the book Monty that he wrote, that his family were, and I quote, "poor, but it was a uniform poverty. Everybody was in the same boat, so we didn't notice." In his early life, Mountford lived in Adelaide, and he moved between different jobs. Selling stereoscopes was one of them. He worked as a stable boy, a blacksmith striker, tram conductor, and much more. And he was clearly ambitious, and by the age of 20, he was undertaking correspondence courses in mechanics and engineering, and later on he went to work for the Postal Service. And even while he was working for the Postal Service, he continued his education at what is now the University of South Australia. He got married in 1914, had children, and in 1920, and this is the relevant bit for this talk, he arrived in Darwin in 1920, and he was the mechanic in charge at the post office in Darwin. And it was here in Darwin that Mountford's interest in Aboriginal culture and in collecting material culture really began. After returning to Adelaide in about 1923, and after his wife passing away in 1925, Mountford and his father began travelling around South Australia. And it was during these trips that he began to come across rock art and start recording rock art sites. He made contact with Norman Tyndale at the South Australian Museum, who encouraged him to continue exploring. And later in the symposium, Philip Jones is going to be discussing this period and the period following in a lot more detail. So I'm going to skip over this next bit. But in 1948, oh, and I should probably explain the photograph that's on your screen. So we have Charles Mountford, we have Stocker, we have Tyndale, of course, in the Beret, and we have Hackett as well. And this is on the 1935 expedition to the Warburton Range. So by 1948, Mountford had attained a certain level of knowledge, particularly in relation to Aboriginal art and particularly in relation to the Pitjantjatjara, Adnambutna and Aranda people and other groups around South Australia. He had no formal training at this stage, but he did go back and do some graduate studies later in his life. He also had experience making films, including Turinga and Walkabout, which some of you may have seen. He had experience collecting ethnographic artefacts and artworks, and experience documenting stories from Aboriginal communities in South Australia and Western Australia. Now, his work, and in particular his films, caught the attention of the then Federal Minister for Information, Arthur Calwell, who saw the film's potential for publicity, international publicity, and I believe Kim Beazley's going to talk a little bit more about Calwell's work later on. Mountford was offered a job in Calwell's department and sent on a lecture tour to promote Australia overseas, and particularly in the USA. So on February the 2nd, 1945, Mountford presented his work to 4,000 members of the National Geographic Society. And in the audience were members of the National Geographic Society Research Committee who approached him following the presentation and said, "Why don't you apply for some funding to put on an expedition to Arnhem Land?" And, of course, this is the origins of the expedition, the 1948 expedition. And already we can see that lovely interplay that's going on between politics, propaganda and science. And already maybe they're starting to sit a little bit uneasily. Charles Mountford's proposal to the National Geographic Society included study in four main areas. And I should say, I'll skip that. I was going to show you a few quotes about why he put this particular proposal in. And one of them is that he states, "Knowing that the simple art of these people would be the first aspect of their culture to disappear, I've concentrated on the investigation and recording of all phases of their art." So the official proposal that went in 1945 to the National Geographic Society included these study areas, and you can see it's the art of the bark paintings, the art of the body paintings, general ethnology, and music in secular and ceremonial life. These are the areas that Mountford was interested in, and he followed these through. Even though the official aims changed for the expedition, these are the things he was particularly interested in. We all know Mountford's proposal was accepted, and he was granted $10,000 to put the expedition together. There were also unpublicised aims almost immediately for the expedition, and this included, these references come from 1947, so we're 18 months later now. The first one was needing to make a nutritional health survey of the natives and their food as a guide for future administration, and secondly, to determine the food resources of land and sea as data for future military operations, and I quote, "This was urgently needed but not available during the last war." So clearly international politics and propaganda was just as important as science for the Arnhem Land Expedition. And this points us to Arthur Calwell. And I believe Calwell's daughter's in the audience today. Are you here somewhere?
She's just popped out.
Oh, she's popped out. Right. Calwell, as we said, was Minister for Information in 1943 and remained in this position until 49. And it was during this period that he really discovered, if you like, Charles Mountford, for seeing the use of his films for publicity for the department, but also as living up to the aims of the department. So Calwell saw the National Geographic Society funding, here she is, she's just walked in, as a wonderful opportunity for promoting political and scientific relations with the US. He arranged for the Commonwealth Government to pay Mountford's full wage, plus his expenses for the expedition, and to pay for transport as well. The Minister for Air, the Minister for the Army, the Minister for Health all offered support, including transport, food, and importantly, three scientists from the Australian Institute of Anatomy who were allowed to join the expedition to study Aboriginal health and nutrition. Arthur Calwell was responsible for the massive expansion of the expedition and the associated publicity. He was also at the forefront of funding and personnel negotiations. And as Alexander Wetmore from the Smithsonian Institution wrote in relation to the Arnhem Land Expedition, "We look forward with keen interest to this work, particularly to the close association that it brings between representatives of our two governments. We may, I trust, consider this a beginning to an even closer cooperation in future scientific matters than has existed to date." So with the involvement of other institutions, including the Australian Museum, Fred McCarthy, and the Smithsonian Institution, the expedition Mountford had originally planned to really just be himself and a few mates, had grown to 17 people from a range of disciplines. The expedition, I should also mention, was meant to take place in 1947, but because of certain nuclear weapons testing in the Pacific that was going on, the Smithsonian scientists had to go and be diverted to that work. So Caldwell decided without the Americans, there wouldn't be enough publicity and we should delay for a year so they could still come and join it. But ironically, I think this allowed Mountford's team more time to be able to prepare for what was a very ambitious work schedule. I don't expect you to all read that, but I thought I should put a list of all the expedition members up there while I talk. So the expedition team now included Mountford as leader, Smithsonian Institution archaeologist Frank Setzler as deputy leader. It also included a botanist, who we have in the audience today, a mammalogist, an ichthyologist, an ornithologist, an anthropologist, a photographer, a cinephotographer, and a team of medical and nutritional scientists, plus support staff. Now, these 17 men and women all travelled together across very remote parts of Arnhem Land for 7 months. And as you can see, I don't really have time in my talk to go through each of them, but this gives you some idea of the people and their jobs during the expedition. And we'll be hearing about a lot more of these people as we go. I'd like to now briefly introduce each of the base camps to you and give you a taste of the research that was taking place there. Now, after leaving Darwin, the expedition set up its first base camp on Groote Island in the Gulf of Carpentaria. 3 months later, they moved to Yirrkala, and then 3 months following that, onto Owen Pelly, or Wumalanya, in Western Arnhem Land. Mountford suggests in the records of the expedition that he chose these camps because they represented different environments and would therefore produce diverse research outcomes. He also chose a camp on the Roper River, which, due to delays in arriving on Groote Island with the supplies, was cancelled. So there were originally intended to be 4 base camps. After 2 weeks in Darwin, waiting for their supplies to arrive overland from Adelaide, the team made its way to Umbacumba on Groote Island. Most of the team arrived by a Catalina flying boat. However, a few team members decided to make the journey by sea and were stranded when a storm pushed their ship, the Phoenix, onto a reef near the mouth of the Liverpool River. And they were, it didn't sink, but it was stuck tight for 5 weeks as the crew attempted to save the expedition's equipment and food. And one of the stranded expedition members was National Geographic Society Hal Walker. He was a photographer. And Hal later documented this journey, he had 5 weeks to do it, in Cruise to Stone Age Arnhem Land, which is published in the National Geographic magazine. The media had an absolute field day, as evidenced by this article from the Daily Mirror. Starving scientists. A Catalina left Darwin at a daylight today with emergency supplies for the American-Australian scientific expedition on Groote Island as the launch, which was to have followed the expedition with supplies, broke down. Until the aeroplane arrives, the scientists will have a first-class chance of studying native foodstuffs. So, now, Peter Bassett Smith was one of those waiting on Groote Island at this time, and he clearly had a little bit of time on his hands because he managed to pen an epic song about the Phoenix and about Groote Island. I'm not going to read this whole song out, and I'm certainly not going to sing it, but here are a few lines I thought you'd like in honour of our friend Peter Bassett Smith, who wasn't able to be here with us today. He titled this poem, or this song, "The Phoenix Never Came In." An expedition left the north one day, flew by Catalina far away. All the stores were to have gone ahead on the barge Phoenix instead, but the Phoenix never came in. While on Groote Island they were near starving, she hadn't even left Darwin. Oh, the Phoenix never came in. All was clear. Well, all was well on a clear blue sea, eggs for breakfast, caviar for tea. Super service made the voyage fine on the Capricornian line, but the Phoenix never came in. Not to be outdone, Fred Gray, whom I'll be discussing in a second, also wrote a song calling it Shores of Umbacumba, and I've put the spelling up so you can see it's not just my pronunciation. So, from the shores of Umbacumba to the great Unurugu, this place is so full of scientists, there's no room for me or you. They're eating lots of tucker and sitting in their tents and waiting for the Phoenix in the cause of science. Now, Mountford and his team set up a camp next to Fred Gray's so-called native settlement at Umbacumba. And by joining forces with Fred Gray, Mountford thought he would have a better chance of becoming acquainted with the local Aboriginal people and also access to facilities. And later today, Martin Thomas, sitting here in front of me, is going to be discussing some of this time on Groote Island, particularly from the memories of Jerry Blitner, who really gives us one of the few first-hand Indigenous recollections of what happened in this place. And these recollections are recorded shortly before Jerry passed away. To give you some idea of the activities that were taking place, I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And some of the images up here are from Groote Eylandt. Of course, this is Fred and Marjorie Gray and Charles Mountford sitting with some Groote Eylanders. And down the bottom, playing with a toy boat that they made and was later collected. So what were they doing? Expedition nutritionist Margaret MacArthur was lucky enough to arrive by air into Groote Eylandt, and she didn't let delays in equipment arriving prevent her from starting her research. By the time the Phoenix did arrive, she'd already set up a nutrition camp at Hempel Bay. Later she worked with Raymond Specht and Native Affairs Officer Howard Coates on Bickerton Island, and she was aiming to investigate food gathering techniques and nutrition of the local people, while Specht was concentrating on the botany of the area. Ray Speck's diaries give an interesting insight into a camp life during the expedition's time on Groote Eylandt, and it does feel a little strange to be standing up here reading out a part of Ray's diary while he's sitting there looking at me, but I'm going to do it anyway. He writes, and you did mention this at the reunion as well, I noticed, and I quote, "Apart from two excellent cooks, helped by two Aborigines, who do wonders with tinned food, we have many other amenities. We each have a tent that serves as a laboratory as well. We have an open invitation to visit and use the Greys' homestead whenever we like. The Greys have put themselves out for us. They have even put electric light down to our mess tent, as well as water. Our work has definitely upset their routine. Fred Gray, in typical English style, doesn't deny it, but passes it off with a smile. His wife Marjorie appreciates the company. Her Desert Island Discs, gramophone records, including I'm Also Alone in a Strange Land, haunt us at night." I thought that was a beautiful way of describing it. Another example of the work taking place on Groote Eylandt included the production of face casts by the Smithsonian's Frank Setzler, pictured here. Setzler took 8 plaster casts of Aboriginal people from Umbakumba using a negacol technique. He wanted these casts in order to produce life-size models of Australian Aboriginal people to display in the Smithsonian Institution. And as you can see from this photo, they were made into statues, and they are still held today at the National Museum of Natural History in DC. Thomas Amagula, who is in the audience, there he is, can be seen in this photo holding the cast of his relative Kumbiala. While dozens of men and women assisted the expedition on Groote Eylandt, it was Nangapiana, and I apologise if I am pronouncing that incorrectly, who was singled out as a key informant, and he's pictured here now. He was also an artist, and his work is represented in many collections that now exist from the 1948 expedition, including the painting that you can see on the screen there. Thanks to the fact that the expedition members kept detailed journals, we know the names, or at least the names the expedition members were calling people, for many of the local Aboriginal people. This includes names such as Banjo, Barrawunda, Kumbiala, Kulpidja, Mini Mini Mamarika, Dakalara Waramara, somebody they called India or Jindia, and a man they nicknamed Nipad. On Wednesday, you're going to be hearing from some of the relatives of these people during the community panel, and we're really pleased the Groote Eylandt mob could be here today. The expedition moved to its second base camp, Yirrkala, on Thursday, July 8th. Yirrkala was a Methodist overseas mission station at the time, having been established in 1935, and it was again decided to set up camp next to existing facilities like this. A few days after arriving, the base camp had a visit. They received a wireless message from Darwin informing them that Arthur Driver, Administrator of the Northern Territory, Elvin Siebert, American Consul from Adelaide, Kevin Murphy, Deputy Administrator with the Department of Information, would be landing at Yirrkala at 9:30 a.m. with the intention of visiting their camp. So they all quickly shaved and washed and got dressed. And soon after Murphy and Driver arrived, they requested a private audience with Mountford and Setzler. And it emerged that the Department of Information was slightly annoyed with the delays and poor arrangements that had been made to date, or what they saw as poor arrangements. The result of this meeting was that Mountford was asked to relinquish his leadership of the scientific aspects of the expedition to the American Frank Setzler. And Mountford was told to continue producing his films, as that was his job, rather than undertaking anthropological research. And I mention this because it is a significant event and it changed a lot of things that happened. So Setzler was reluctant to accept, but he didn't refuse straight away, and this is something that Mountford in his letters clearly never fully forgave him for. Setzler considered the offer overnight. The next morning he discussed it with his American colleagues, who very quickly advised him to refuse, and he immediately wired Kevin Murphy and said, "I can't accept the position." The fieldwork in Yirrkala was not off to a good start. But there was one very good thing that came out of this meeting, and that was that Murphy arranged for Bill Harney to join the expedition, stating, "My only concern," and he's writing to the Americans here, "is that you and your colleagues be given ample opportunity for profitable scientific research. To this end, I'm sending Bill Harney as a guide, confident that his knowledge of the terrain will give you what you want." And this is an Eric Jolliffe cartoon that was produced. Eric Jolliffe spent a couple of weeks with them up in Arnhem Land and produced a great deal of cartoons. And can you read? Can everybody read that at the bottom? Yeah, good. So what were the researchers up to at Yirrkala? Mountford and McCarthy were working with and collecting paintings from artists such as Mawalan Marika, Wanjuk Marika, Narichan Maimaru and others during their time at Yirrkala. As Margot Neal's going to be discussing this afternoon, while Mountford's collection of objects and especially paintings remained constant during the expedition, his record keeping did slowly deteriorate, in part due to the controversy of the attempted demotion of him. So by the time we get to Yirrkala, and then especially by the time we get to Owen Pelly, the records associated with the paintings are very poor. He used the same method of collecting ethnographic artefacts throughout, and he spent most of his time at the base camps during the expedition. It was a very different story for the other expedition members, who scattered themselves around islands and mainland sites off Arnhem Land. McCarthy, Miller, Setzler, MacArthur and Harney all travelled to Port Bradshaw, where they conducted independent research. Margaret MacArthur established another nutrition camp with two Aboriginal companions, causing Charles Mountford great concern, as he felt that a woman in 1948 shouldn't be alone in Arnhem Land. Nevertheless, he let her go and she set up her camp. She considered that she could get a truer picture of Aboriginal people if she was by herself. That's a picture of Margaret MacArthur. I'll quote quickly. This is a newspaper article about Margaret MacArthur. "Scientist gamer the Ned Kelly, Melbourne, Tuesday. Miss Margaret MacArthur, young Canberra nutrition expert who spent 3 weeks among savage Arnhem Land Aborigines, was gamer the Ned Kelly," Mr. D.C. White said today. And Mr. D.C. White was commander of the Kuru, a ship that was transporting them around Arnhem Land. On their return from Port Bradshaw, Setzler and McCarthy travelled to Milingimby Island to carry out archaeological research, while others concentrated their study around the camp. There was growing tension between certain expedition members by this stage, possibly the worst of which was between Charles Mountford and Fred McCarthy. And again, I think Philip Jones is going to be touching upon this later on. So I won't go into too much detail, but I'll give you an example of the type of relationship these men had by the time they got to Yirrkala. And most of this, of course, comes from Fred McCarthy's diaries, so they were much, much worse. And I quote, "I told him, Mountford, that I was fed up with the bloody expedition on the basis of the constant jealousy of all the work that I was doing and the constant arguments about the number of and the distribution of the specimens." This is on Milingimby Island, some of the excavations that were taking place. Back at Yirrkala, the team continued to work with large numbers of local Aboriginal people in areas ranging from general camp maintenance to painting to string figures to medical research. But one person who stands out as a central figure and whom I mentioned earlier is Mawalan Marika. And he was born in 1908 and was a highly respected leader of people in northeast Arnhem Land and a contributor to the famous Bark Petitions. He was a significant artist and is represented in many art gallery and museum collections. The figure on screen shows Marlon with one of his wooden sculptures that was being produced in August 1948 at Yirrkala. Many of Marlon's family members are also represented in this collection, including Wanjuk, and we're very pleased to have representatives from Yirrkala at the conference. Overall, Yirrkala seems to have been a comfortable and productive camp for the group, and large collections were made by all of the expedition members. Most of the team went to Darwin for a week after Yirrkala to secure their collections and restock their supplies before moving over to Owen Pelly by September the 20th. The final base camp for the expedition proved to be the hardest for most of the expedition members. It was hot, the local mission didn't really want them there, and the team members had already been in the field for 6 months. There is no doubting, however, that this final base camp provided some of the most important scientific findings of the expedition. The group set up camp next to the Owen Pelly Billabong, a site that is now home to Inulak Arts and Crafts Association. Literally, it stands right on where their camp was. And we look forward to hearing from those representatives on Thursday. The township of Owen Pelly sits in a country belonging to the Mengirji people, and in 1948 was a Church Missionary Society settlement with a very long and complex history. In 1948, most of the expedition members remained in or very near to Owen Pelly throughout the 3 months they were conducting their research. But some of the expedition members, including Hal Walker, Peter Bassett-Smith and Ray Specht, have suggested to me that it was at Owen Pelly that they had the least amount of contact with local Aboriginal people. And this was due in part to the mission not being willing to spare people from their normal jobs. The traditional owner of the region at the time was a man by the name of Nipa Marakara, who had been traditional owner since before the first white people came and settled in the region. He oversaw the movement of Paddy Kale into this area in the early 1900s. He oversaw the establishment of the church in the 1925. He worked with Baldwin Spencer, Ronald and Catherine Burnt, and he was still traditional owner when Mountford turned up with his team in 1948. He was a remarkable man who led a remarkable life, but very little is recorded about him. In the records, Mountford refers to him as Kumatan. And Nipa Marakara's artworks, one of which can be seen on the screen there, is represented in most of the collections. There is an interesting statement from Colin Simpson, the ABC journalist who visited them in Owen Pelly. He states, "The old men Mountford brought back to the tent had been hoeing the mission's melon patch. They looked unimpressive. They looked dreadful in casts off and shapeless relics of felt hats. They sat down on the grass, folding themselves down in that slow and diffident way that they have with white men, one wringing his nose out with his fingers, another coughing. I thought to myself, nothing much can come of this. I was judging on appearances, presuming that the old men had shed their validity as Aborigines and put off their culture because they had put on rags of white men's clothing and were taking handouts from the mission. It was these old men and others who transformed with paint and fervour, gave us the unforgettable performance of the corroboree a few days later." I'm getting my warning, so I'm going to wind up. So what collections did the expedition members actually produce? Well, it is remarkable. Over 50,000 archaeological, ethnographic and natural history specimens. This included approximately 13,500 botanical specimens, courtesy of Ray Specht. 30,000 fish, 850 birds, 460 mammals, and over 2,000 ethnographic artefacts. And this was just in a 7 to 8 month period. These researchers had formed some of the most significant Australian collections of the 20th century, and collections we still know very little about. After the expedition, well, rumours had leaked to the press that all was not well among the expedition members as it began to reach its conclusion. Now, Mountford realised in order to protect the reputation of the expedition and its stakeholders, he's going to need to present a united front at the end. And he wrote to Alexander Wetmore at the Smithsonian on November the 5th, 1948, stating that he was afraid his letters had caused a wrong impression and that actually everything was very harmonious, and he claimed he hadn't heard any arguments during the time they were in the field. But in the same letter, he requested that Frank Setzler not be allowed anywhere near the Australian ministerial or departmental heads for fear he would not be discreet. Now, Wetmore, sitting in his office back in the Smithsonian, was receiving letters from everybody on this expedition, and he probably knew more about what was going on in the field than the people in the field. So, for example, Herbert Dagnan wrote to him in August, stating that Mountford wishes all of the party to arrive together in Adelaide at the end because of the expedition's recent troubles. After managing to direct a 7 to 8 month expedition, Mountford now had to fight for his reputation and his job. This was clearly a politically complex and logistically daunting expedition, and in particular, Mountford's sacrifices to make it happen were extreme. On top of the pressure placed upon him, on the leader from the Government of Australia, came the responsibility of satisfying all of those museums in Australia and the US, as well as the National Geographic Society and each and every one of those scientists. Eventually, these worries took their toll on Mountford's health and he began to suffer fainting spells. Setzler commented in his diary, "Our main hope now is to hold him down from worry and exhaustion so that we can all safely return to Darwin." There are many aspects of this expedition that I have not touched upon. This includes issues such as the relationships that were formed between the expedition members, including Fred McCarthy and Frank Setzler, who corresponded for decades. And we'll hear more about that later on from Ray as well, about these relationships that were formed. Or the encouragement that somebody like Margaret MacArthur, a young female nutritionist, received from many of her colleagues to continue and expand her research as she did. Or the fact that the work undertaken in 1948 today causes, some of the work undertaken in 1948 causes distress for Aboriginal communities. I know that all of these issues and many more are going to be touched upon throughout this symposium, and I think it's exciting to think about the new information and projects that could emerge from this. So this symposium is about legacies, and I hope with this introduction you can further appreciate the papers and the interviews and the workshops and the films that have been drawn together over the next few days. I'm sure that by Friday we'll have a much better understanding of the significance and legacies of this important event. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.